From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Sometimes our guests have so much good stuff to say that we can't fit it all into one show. So let out your belt a notch. This week, we're bringing you Delicious Leftovers.
When human creativity is working, it's not pretentious. It's not about money. It's like nature.
But like, how do you work from being a set dresser to being a director in Chicago?
We thought we were going crazy.
I just started DMing talk show hosts and saying like, hi, it's me, Kathy Griffin. Can I come on your show or do you think I'm an ISIS?
Ethan Hawke tells us how he makes his eclectic project choices and reflects on two of them, Boyhood and the documentary Seymour, An Introduction. Director George Tillman Jr. explains how writing was the thing that took his career to the next level, even though he really doesn't like doing it. John Cho shares what his film, the thriller Searching, and the 3D Harold and Kumar movie have in common. And finally, Kathy Griffin on how to hustle following a career catastrophe. But first on the news banter, some reckless early Oscar forecasting. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined, thankfully, after Thanksgiving, by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
Let us banter. A bunch of Academy Award movies are opening over the holiday weekend. Academy Award hopefuls, I should say. And I am finding this race interesting because, to me, the movie that stands out in the pack, and I'm looking at, you know, what we're projecting as possible frontrunners for Best Picture, Star is Born, Green Book, The Favorite, Black Panther, etc. There's a few more. But the one that, to me, is most people seem to feel is the standout is Roma, which is Alfonso Cuarón's reminiscence about Mexico City in the 70s. And people seem to be using the word, like, masterpiece a lot. And it is a Netflix movie. So to me, this is going to potentially pose the question really starkly. Will the Academy support a Netflix film if it is, in fact, a masterpiece?
Right. And that's what's splitting the Academy right now, because there is a faction of the Academy led by prominent filmmakers, Christopher Nolan, Steven Spielberg, who do not believe that a movie on Netflix should be eligible for Best Picture, because it is, in Steven Spielberg's words, a TV movie. And Netflix is doing everything they can this award season to escape that pejorative description, so much so that they're willing to alter their business model to appeal to Academy members. They're putting Roma in theaters. It was in theaters this weekend, and they're doing that exclusively for 3 weeks before it debuts on Netflix. They've never done that before for a movie like this. Will it work? We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, in the past, they've tried to make serious movies, you know, that would appeal to the Academy, like Beasts of No Nation. But it's also a really harsh, dark movie about child soldiers, violent and dark. You know, it's the kind of thing that Academy members might be reluctant to queue up during the holidays. This Roma is a different kettle of fish, so we will see. And now I'm going to go somewhat out on a limb here, and I'm just going to be a total, like, spoiler, except I could be completely wrong. I think we could probably pick out, like, best actors and best actor almost now. So do you have two in your mind? Because I just want to see if we match.
Best actress is a tough one for me. Glenn Close is amazing in The Wife. Lady Gaga is great in A Star is Born. I could see Melissa McCarthy being a dark horse candidate in a dramatic role for this movie, Can You Ever Forgive Me? You know, there's at least three or four that I could actually see not just getting nominated, but winning.
I think they'll get nominated. Are those people you list? Very likely. I'm going to give a shout out to Olivia Colman in The Favorite because I think she is great. But I think Lady Gaga is going to win this thing. I think it's just the sort of thing that the Academy loves. And that is very early, my prediction. So we'll see.
Wow, that's bold. That's
bold.
A bold prediction. She's great in the film. There's so many factors that go into who ultimately ends up winning. You know, these performances that a narrative gets created around them. They spend 3 months doing press and hopefully they don't have any missteps. So who knows who's going to win? On the actor side, I think it's a little bit more clear, but I'm curious what you think.
Okay, this is where I'm either being more bold or more completely foolish because you've seen this movie and I haven't. The movie I'm talking about is Vice, which is about Dick Cheney. And we have the classic Christian Bale gained 40-something pounds transformation. And as he himself has said, you don't look at Christian Bale and think Dick Cheney, which is who he portrays. So that is the classic actor transforms into portrayal of a real person formula. You've seen it. What do you think?
I think he's probably going to win. I mean, even if the movie itself doesn't go all the way, I think Christian Bale is so astonishing in this part. You know, you think you know him, but 20 minutes into the movie, you have forgotten all about him. And it's not just mimicry. It's a great performance. But there's a lot of others. You know, if Black Panther runs the table and there's momentum behind Black Panther, I could see either Chadwick Boseman or Michael B. Jordan getting in there as best actor. Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali in Green Book are both great.
Yeah, we'll see. I think those were outstanding performances, but I just have that feeling. I'm just sticking my neck out. Now, let me just briefly turn to this idea. There's been some talks, apparently, between Comcast and WarnerMedia about teaming up because Netflix is huge. Disney will have a huge streaming service, which many people nicknamed the Netflix killer. And clearly, WarnerMedia and Comcast don't want to be left out, with Comcast being NBC Universal. So they're talking about pooling all of their property and creating a streaming service. It makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, they're both big, but they're not necessarily positioned as Disney and Netflix have been.
No, they're not name brands like Disney is. But it's interesting, the discussions. I mean, who knows if this will actually happen. But the focus right now, the obsession, for lack of a better word, is on how to go direct to the consumer with a streaming offering that has the most robust offering of content possible. And if you look at the libraries of both WarnerMedia and NBC Universal, they're pretty significant. Just on the film side, WarnerMedia has access to about 7,000 films, and NBC Universal, which owns Universal Pictures, has access to about 5,000 films. So if you combine those to get 12,000, that's triple the amount of films that Netflix currently has access to, about 4,000. And that number at Netflix is probably going to go down as more providers yank their content to start their own over-the-top services. Netflix is, of course, trying to furiously produce its own original content that it can own, but it just can't produce it fast enough to match these studios that have libraries from 80, 90, 100 years. So that's a pretty attractive offering if you can put together a streaming service that has triple the number of films that Netflix does.
Yes, it's going to get interesting in the days ahead. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. When Ethan Hawke joined us on The Business to talk about his most recent project, Blaze, his film about the country singer-songwriter Blaze Foley, he told us how early in his career he disappointed his agents at CAA by deciding that he was not focused on becoming a big movie star. Instead, he wanted to pursue projects that interested him. That explains how he ended up spending more than 12 years as an actor in Richard Linklater's Boyhood, and why he made a documentary about an octogenarian classical piano teacher.
My thing is, I want to work with talented people and be in the room with talented. If that's Julie Delpy, then put me in the room. If that's Denzel Washington, put me in the room. If that's Richard Linklater, put me in the room. If that's Tom Stoppard, go. You know, and so I kind of don't care if it's theater or movies. I know that when you're around, if you're in a rehearsal room with Sam Shepard, you don't want to be anywhere else. It's a very interesting place to be. And you can take some, for lack of a better word, it's a word's coming up in this conversation, but you can take some of that energy that happened in that room and you can bring it with you. And, you know, and the same thing happens on the rehearsal for Boyhood. There was a weird energy around those young people and what Linklater was going after and using time as clay. You know, it's a deadly word, but it's creativity.
Oh my God, it was genius.
And when human creativity is working, it's not pretentious. It's not about money. It's like nature. It just is. It's like breathing. You know, it's inevitable. And it feels really good to be near.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about Boyhood just because, and he came on the show and talked
Linklater
about
it.
Yeah, he did. He was great. And I was just, the idea that you're doing this year after year, I mean, obviously you had a collaboration with him on other films. So it was just, yes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we were writing the Before trilogy at the same time. It was a natural extension of other work that we were doing, the way that we were talking and thinking about time and cinema's relationship to time and how the world is changing. And he wanted me to do a portrait of a father and have 12 years to do it. It's very, I'm not sure an actor had ever been offered that.
I doubt it.
You know? So I remember sitting, it was right after my son was born. It was like sticking your finger in an electrical socket. I couldn't believe what a good idea this was. And then when I saw the final cut and knew that he'd sailed that ship into port, you know, probably 14 years after we had the first conversation, you know, it's an exercise in patience that was kind of mind-blowing.
Was there ever a year when he was like, okay, it's time to come back, and you're like, actually, I'm doing this play or something?
To be totally honest with you, you spent time with Rick. It was the opposite. I would say, Rick, dude, come on. He's so patient and so zen. I was like, I'm doing this play, and if we don't do my scenes like before rehearsal starts, it's going to be 9 months before I can come to Texas for more than 2 days. He'd be like, oh, okay, let me think about it.
Good for you.
And Patricia too, you know, everybody. We all fell hard in love with it.
I definitely fell in love with it. So this, you know, you sort of lead, I guess, a meandering thing from platform to platform, you know, theater, books. You came to a documentary at some point.
I made a documentary.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. And I don't know what, I mean, you met this guy and you said this guy should be a movie.
I call Seymour an introduction. A lot of people turn 40 and they like have a midlife crisis and buy a Porsche or a Ferrari or they ruin their marriage or something like that. I made a documentary about an 88-year-old piano maestro. I was doing a play. I got invited to this dinner party I really didn't want to go to because I was losing my voice. But my friend was dying and he really wanted me to come to this dinner. And I went to this dinner. I got seated next to this old man, Seymour Bernstein, and he was so beautiful. And he asked me, he knew that I was hurting. And we talked briefly at this dinner in a way that, I don't know if you've ever had this experience. You know, when somebody just sees into you and they just ask the most probing questions gently. And I was really taken by him. And I came home that night and I started feverishly Googling him and telling my wife, somebody needs to make a documentary about this guy. He's incredible. And then I wrote him an email telling him how great it was. And he wrote me back and invited me to come listen to him play. And I brought my daughter to his tiny one-room studio apartment that he's lived in for 50-something years. And he played for us. And it was like floating in outer space. It was like going to Jupiter and back. You know, the way that music can lift a person. And I really thought more people needed to have this experience of meeting Seymour. So I tried to talk Linkletter into doing a documentary about him, and it went nowhere. And I tried to talk Alexandra Shiva into doing a documentary about him. And finally, my wife, Ryan, said, well, let's us do it. And I think I did it mostly because I wanted to spend time with Seymour. Just a reason to, like, do something creative with him. And it was a big learning lesson for me. It's a great midlife crisis.
Next up, director George Tillman Jr. His newest film, The Hate U Give, is still playing in some theaters. He also produced the Barbershop franchise and directed Men of Honor, a movie about naval divers starring Cuba Gooding Jr. and Robert De Niro. Tillman grew up in Milwaukee and studied cinema in Chicago, but he still had no idea how to get to Hollywood. The answer came in the form of an idea that he eventually turned into the 1997 film Soul Food with Vivica Fox and Vanessa Williams. That was the spark he needed, but still, there were struggles ahead. You had decided, I think, earlier that the way to get into the business was to write your way in.
Yeah, and I'm not really a writer at all. I tell, even today, I got the worst grammar. I take me forever to write. It took me 2.5 years with Soul Food. I had 3 read-throughs before I actually sold the movie on my own. And I slaved over it and just went over it without a job. I had nothing else to do. I felt like that was my quickest way to direct. Prior to that, when I got out of school, out of Columbia College, I worked as a set dresser on a movie that was shot in Chicago called Mo' Money that Damon Wayans was shooting in town. Mm-hmm. I somehow got my way into being a set dresser and I saw how it was done. But I'm like, how do you work from being a set dresser to being a director in Chicago? So the writing was the way. And I always tell people, like, I just had a story. That story was very specific at that time. It was very unique in terms that it was about soul food dinner, about community. And I just got somebody to correct my grammar. And I just went in and I sold the script. And I haven't really wrote much since. I do some tweaks when I get development with other writers.
Right.
I'm able to understand that better.
But you're like, done with that.
I'm done with that. I wish I could do more of that. I just
really?
Remember.
It sounds like you did not love it.
It takes so long, and the writing today is so sophisticated. So with television and the way writers conceive and characters. And I love great material, and I don't have the ability to get me there as a writer. But the techniques and William Goldman and doing it, I can be able to have a verbalization with someone
right.
to get me there quicker.
In the story sense.
Yes, yes.
Let's talk for a second about Men of Honor.
Yep.
Men of Honor was a different world for you because I think I saw you describe it, you know, the white world movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And how's that different? I mean, I know it's different, but how?
Yeah, it was just different because once I did a movie with Hal Holbrook and Robert De Niro, you know, it was always Hollywood was separate. It's not as much anymore. It's
white Hollywood, black Hollywood.
Yeah, it was just like I go to white events and white, because of my association with De Niro or with Hal Holbrook or with some of the actors that was there. And it's a whole different world because it's a lot more money involved when you're working with major stars. So that was my introduction into that world. And then with my association with De Niro, who's a great, you know, great friend. He's one of those guys who just maintain friendships with you. I still talk to today and actually showed him The Hate U Give about a month ago. It's just still friends. That you just allow more access than when you're doing an African-American film that's $7 million, you know?
Access to?
You have access, more marketing, you meet more people, you have more sense of more attention, you know? The ideal of working a film being international, that film worked internationally. I was able to travel for the first time out of the country. So full, we didn't go no further than Boston, probably, you know?
Yeah,
so,
well, that was, and I don't know, to some extent, that still is a concept that
yeah.
these movies, African-American movies, don't travel well. We've seen some of them break that.
Yeah, and that's what I really learned in that process. Amazing working with those two. Those guys are amazing. And
I think I read you had some trouble with the crew because you were trying to show that you were so worried about not being seen as in charge. Correct me if I've got that wrong.
Yeah, no, it was, the crew was amazing. It was just you know, that was an easy movie actually in terms of production. It was just that we shot, it's one of the last films where you can shoot 80 days. I shot 80 days on that movie. It was the water, just being on the water was complicated, shooting.
Shooting on the water.
Shooting, yeah. It was in San Pedro, shooting on the water. And then shooting the tank. That movie went on forever. but it was a really great process, and I learned so much on that film.
Coming up after a short break, John Cho tells us why making a very Harold and Kumar 3D Christmas nearly drove him to the brink. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. For our post-Thanksgiving show, we're bringing you some delicious leftovers, morsels that we had to edit out of earlier interviews, but were just too good to leave on the cutting room floor. When the thriller Searching came out this summer, director Anish Chaganty and star John Cho stopped in at the studio and explained how they made this one-of-a-kind film, set entirely on computer screens. John Cho plays a father distraught over his missing teenage daughter. He combs through every digital clue he can to locate her. Deborah Messing plays against type as a no-nonsense cop assigned to the case. When Cho first heard the pitch for Searching, he agreed it was a good story, but had a lot of doubts about the mechanics of the whole thing.
Really, my questions for him when we finally met were, how's this going to be a movie? And he assured me that, you know, there was going to be this camera on my face that was going to be static, and that was going to be one challenge, but the other camera, my eye, was going to behave like a traditional camera and move and pan and zoom and do all these things. And so he said, this will be a movie. And that's what I just didn't want to make a YouTube video.
It's your eye. I never thought of it. Yeah, it's totally your eye. Our camera is your eye. Wow.
Are you just figuring this out right
yeah,
now?
Just like, for us, I was like, we're drawing attention to, yeah, we're telling our own story with the way the camera's framed, but the camera is your eye. Yeah. I guess I never put the, I knew that. I knew that. I directed
totally
the movie. I knew that. But I didn't know that. Yeah.
There's knowing and there's knowing.
Yeah, exactly.
You
do,
so that is how you have there's sequences where it's a security camera or a nanny cam kind of such, and you do zoom in sometimes, and that's the eye of John. Is
yeah, I mean, I guess in some sequences we become omniscient. You know, we're basically his eye. Our camera's always focusing on whatever is taking his emotional attention. You know, whether if it's a statistic that says the majority of missing kids in California aren't found. Or it's a little clue, or it's a little cursor, or it's a little window that he kind of comes back to because there's a clue there. That's one aspect of it. And then there's the other aspect because this movie's always evolving. It's not always him behind the computer. Sometimes he's out actually in the real world. And the way we're seeing the footage is through a video that was uploaded on YouTube or a live
news feed,
you know? And in those cases, the camera becomes more omniscient, you know?
Although, isn't it, I always felt like those news feeds, I'm watching that news
from
feed
later
on.
Yeah.
Even though it's me. Yeah. I'm watching a YouTube video of myself or whatever.
But in the film, when you're looking, doing all this clicking, you're searching, you know, click, click, click. You're looking at a blank screen when you're doing that.
That's right. Yeah. I was looking at a blank screen.
How did you know exactly where to look?
Well, we had to go over it. We would go over the footage. I'm pretty sure we had tape marks on this dummy laptop. And the eye lines were just really important because there were plot points seeing this, discovering that, and they were very tight, and it was strange, you know, just to be looking at a blank screen, but we just had to be very, very specific.
It makes me think of, I'll date myself, but, you know, I covered the making of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and that was the first time, you know, Bob Hoskins was acting with a
cartoon.
Like a ball on a stick. There was nothing there. There was not even like a person in a bunny costume. Hmm. And he said, the late, great Bob Hoskins told me that at a certain point he started to hallucinate a little bit. I don't know
That's
if that
so
happened.
Funny because the experience that comes to mind is we shot Harold and Kumar 3. A Harold and Kumar Christmas in 3D. I can't remember the exact title. But that was a 3D, early 3D rig, and it was very big. And the map box was so wide that when we did over the shoulders, the actor that I was in the scene with couldn't talk face to face with me. And so Cal and I, he would stand next to the camera, but I had to look at a tape mark, and we thought we were going crazy. And we would, right before the scene, we would like huddle up and look each other in the eye and just run through the scene really fast and do it 4 or 5 times until they called action and then turned to the tape mark because it was our attempt to retain any sense of sanity.
Right, to ground yourselves get used to just saying the lines the same.
Yeah, to feel like you're talking to a person.
Well, it wasn't quite as bad this time, I guess.
Yeah, well.
Maybe it was.
maybe it was worse. No. Yeah, for the scenes with Deborah, we had earpieces in, and I was looking at a very small image of her. We couldn't have her be big because, you know, what you start doing is looking at the whole face, and then your eyes start going like
back and forth.
Back and forth, and it looks like you're looking all over the room. So we had to make her super small.
I mean, there were scenes, those were the scenes of Deborah. There were plenty of scenes, and there are plenty of scenes where David is just, you know, talking to or getting in touch with Margot's friends. And with Deborah, the schedules lined up and everything like that we're able to record at the same time because that's what we wanted to do because there's really meaty scenes. But I remember some sequences where he would be talking to a friend in the story, and the friend is not on set because we're shooting that on another day. And it's basically me, you know, him talking to, like, again, a black screen and me talking right into his ear as the friend in another room.
It's like they're doing an animated movie. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like, to me, it was the ultimate sort of green screen movie to me. It was.
I was going to say it sounded like a black box theater type of thing in a way.
A lot of imagination.
I mean, like Star Trek is a lot like that. You know, we have this big screen in front of us and we're supposed to imagine the torpedoes, the photon torpedoes. But this was 5 or 6 steps beyond that.
Finally, Kathy Griffin. The comedian joined us at the tail end of her Laugh Your Head Off World Tour, so named because of the infamous photo of her holding what appeared to be Donald Trump's decapitated head. After that image hit TMZ, Griffin's career and life as she knew it changed forever. She tells us how she's worked her way back by self-funding her own comedy tour, tweeting nonstop, and by selling merchandise, much of it with a particular political bent.
I won't say the word, but my number one seller at KathyGriffin.com, my number one seller is coffee mugs that say the full word, but F Trump. And my number two seller, believe it or not, are T-shirts that say Team Griffin. And what that shows me is, you know, if you're going to wear a shirt like that, it now has a very different message than before the photo. Prior to the photo, maybe like four gay guys and one soccer mom would be like, oh, is that about Kathy Griffin? Now it's kind of like people are wearing them to protests. I'm actually working on another T-shirt I want to make. Like, I would love to make the definitive protest T-shirt, like one you can wear to all protests and stuff. So for someone my whole career, I've always wanted like a QVC line and all the stuff I'm just too dangerous for. And here I am. I don't want to say it's like I'm making millions, but I will say there are certain products in my little merch store that are flying off the shelves.
And then you record yourself calling people who have bought this stuff. I mean, I feel like you're working the social media. I don't know.
Oh, my gosh. My hustle is on. I call it the hamster wheel. I am on the hamster wheel every day. Yes, I call people personally who bought tickets. I call people personally who bought, you know, a T-shirt. I do a lot of outreach. I'm switching up my social media a lot. I did a great video with this guy, Shane Dawson, who's this giant YouTuber. And he did like over an hour, almost a documentary about kind of the two of us chatting and kind of my situation. And I think it has like 12 million views on YouTube. And yet Chuck Sanders and Hollywood are like, oh, YouTube, that doesn't matter. So I'm kind of in a way trying to ask them to be open-minded about like, well, maybe that's an old idea that YouTubers. But now I actually relate to a lot of these YouTubers because they are so enterprising that when no publicist would touch me, and I now very gratefully am with BWR, but when no publicist would touch me, I just started DMing talk show hosts and saying like, hi, it's me, Kathy Griffin. Can I come on your show or do you think I'm an ISIS? And that's just what I've been doing is just hustling.
Who's had you on?
Well, overseas, I wanted to do a show called Hard Talk, and it's on Sky News and it gets 70 million viewers. So this show almost exclusively hosts heads of state, you know, like really important people. And then I saw Jane Fonda on it and I thought, okay. So I DM'd the host. His name is Steven Sakur and the show is called Hard Talk. And it was a tough interview. He was tough on me and I knew he would be. But now I'm in the commercial. So
in the commercial for the series.
For the series. Mm-hmm. So I consider that a minor victory. I'll take my victories when
absolutely,
I can.
Absolutely.
You know, in my show, I do a lot of acknowledging the mistakes I made and what I would do over. And I do sort of a bit about like, I hate these celebrities when they've come out of a scandal or not. And someone goes, is there anything you would change? Let me talk to Little Kim for a minute. And I don't mean the rapper. I mean, actually, your inner Kim.
My child.
When you talk to her, what do you say now? Like, I get a lot of that, right? And just so you know, I've never been one of those, like, I have no regrets. I have a lot of regrets. I screwed up a lot in my life and my career and my family. Like, so I'm very open about that in the show as well, because I do understand and respect the folks that were legit horrified by that image. I get it, especially if you have any connection to the military. So I'm conscious of that, and yet I do want to finally be unapologetic about the photo because I've really explained it enough, and I've learned those who get it already got it at least like maybe 6 months ago, and those who don't never will.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can listen to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.